Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Ivan, Mike, and the Independent Institute for the invitation to come and chat with you today about space weapons, arms control, and U.S. national security in space. I think we're all in agreement here that the integration of space-based capabilities with the terrestrial warfighting capabilities represents a new phenomenon. Well, it's not new anymore, but it's relatively new in the way that space is utilized for national security purposes. And that's fundamentally different from the Cold War context in which most of the arms control discussions that we were familiar with had taken place. The use of space in the Cold War period was for stability purposes, was for crisis stability purposes. But for today, and as Teresa mentions in the beginning of her remarks, they are targets because those capabilities, if they're targeted, if they're destroyed, could gain an attacker a real advantage over the United States, whether in the short term or the long term, depending on the size of the operation. I would suggest that that's fundamentally a different environment that we're operating in, and that recognition of that environment has to guide our discussions about arms control. I'd also suggest that the relatively peaceful period that we're living in right now in terms of great power competition is not a sustainable one. When we ought to think about futures where the United States or other nations might be engaged in the kind of great power competition that has characterized human history. So I've been asked to address, I think, two questions. One is, why would somebody want to attack us in space? And then secondly, to speak specifically to the Chinese threat. And so I'll try to highlight both of those things briefly. First, as I've alluded to, the integration of space assets with our terrestrial power projection capabilities is both uniquely American at this point and provides a clear incentive to target American spacecraft. If I'm a potential adversary of the United States and I could take out United States precision navigation and timing capabilities, I directly impede the U.S. ability to conduct precision guided warfare. If I can confuse our communications assets, then it's more difficult for my troops on the ground to talk to one another. I, as an adversary, and perhaps one with less quality conventional forces, need that advantage in order to level the playing field. Consequently, in my view, any state preparing for a geopolitical rivalry with the United States could reasonably be expected to pursue strategies to deny the use of these critical enabling assets in times of actual conflict or possess the ability to threaten their destruction and to help shape times of international tension to their advantage. And it's my view that the Chinese example represents both sides of that equation. The Chinese test of their hit-to-kill anti-satellite weapon in January of 2007 captured the headlines, but it's hardly an isolated incident if one takes a long look at their program. General James Cartwright, who is now the deputy strategic on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified before the Armed Services Committee in the Senate last year and put the Chinese threat in the proper context, and so I'll quote from him. He says, "The Chinese have undertaken what we would call a very disciplined and comprehensive continuum of capability against space. Our space capabilities," Cartwright noted. He also notes that the efforts range, quote, "all the way from achieving temporary and reversible effects to permanent damage exacted through direct descent ASAT and eventually core orbital space weapons. Further, the lower-end capabilities," he emphasized, "were not only demonstrated but actually fielded into their forces. This," he concluded, "demonstrates that they have a very comprehensive vision for what they want to be able to do as a nation in their region." Now, let's talk a bit about what China's capabilities really are. It's difficult to judge because the Chinese program certainly is not as transparent as ours, but it is an integrated program, meaning they have their civil and military operations are functionally together. It's clear, though, that they have both the means and the motive to exploit space for security purposes. They possess advanced rocketry, they have capable infrastructure, and they've demonstrated manned spaceflight, which is an indicator of great competence and the ability to operate in a space environment. It's also clear that they're investigating numerous weapons and weapons-capable elements. I've alluded to the direct descent system. As their rocketry becomes more powerful, they'll be able to reach higher and higher orbits should they choose to do so, maybe even possibly GEO with their most advanced ICBM forces. The kinetic kill vehicle that rides on top of that rocket and makes an ASAT capability possible obviously is already proven, and some analysts say it represents a major technological jump compared to where the U.S. and the Soviets were when we were working on such programs. They have that capability. That capability is not going to go away. They're also working on a host of directed energy systems. Preceding the January 2007 test, there were reports in the fall of 2006 that they had blinded National Reconnaissance Office satellites with lasers. Their high and low energy laser program is well established and well documented and could be used for these purposes down the road. And then finally, I'll point out that they have a robust electronic attack and jamming capability. Lots of people are gaining that capability because they're inherently dual-use technologies. All those capabilities are currently held, and there's a host then of more speculative on-orbital efforts, such as the co-orbital ASAT capability that General Cartwright alludes to. Those things may be coming down the road. It's hard to say whether they will or not. That's up to the Chinese to figure out. But I would suggest, given my initial proposition, it's perfectly logical and reasonable for them to make these investments. They need to make those investments in order to level the conventional warfare playing field against the United States. Whether or not they actually anticipate going to war with the United States is unclear, probably low probability, but there will be strategic competition in the international environment going forward. Finally, I just want to make a few comments about a treaty. I presume we'll talk more about this in the question period. So I'll just say that when I look at a treaty environment, I think there are four characteristics that one needs to be able to answer positively that the treaty can provide. First, you have to be able to define clearly what it is you're trying to accomplish. I think, as Pete mentions, defining what a space weapon is a very difficult proposition. As I've tried to allude to in talking about the Chinese capabilities, if you really want to get at the core of the things that can threaten U.S. assets, you'd be dealing with either elements that are dual use, their strategic ballistic missile arsenal, which they're not going to negotiate away in the current context, or are used for commercial dual-use capabilities, such as their electronic warfare capabilities or their laser programs. I can't envision a treaty environment that will get rid of any of those capabilities. You have to be able to monitor compliance. That's a technical problem. I'm not sure that we can monitor compliance in this area. You have to be able to verify that compliance. That's a political judgment. That's something that we can debate about. And then finally, you have to be able to enforce whatever the penalties are that you want to put into place. From my perspective, is compliance observable? I don't think so. Are there significant advantages that can be had by cheating under this kind of environment? I think the answer is clearly yes. Again, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I look forward to the question session.